Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. This is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Laura Clancy about running the family firm, how the monarchy manages its image and our money. So welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I don't want to sort of immediately date the podcast, but this book couldn't be better timed in a week where Britain is seeing the celebration of the Queen's Jubilee. I've immediately forgotten which Jubilee it is.
Platinum. I'm glad I know that.
Platinum, which is 70 years.
Yeah.
And all of the things, like literally all of the things that the book covers are front and center in front of us, you know, almost kind of every minute of every day. Mm-hmm. Certainly, you know, in terms of how the media is discussing this, in terms of some of the things the book talks about right at the very end, actually with particular royal personalities, even, you know, kind of physically on our streets and in our kind of public spaces and stuff like that. But at the same time, and this is how I'd like to sort of introduce the book, this isn't a book that's just about a particular moment in time. Actually, I think it's a book that speaks to, you know, really kind of like long-standing issues in British society, mm-hmm. and is going to be really relevant, you know, moving forward into the years and probably decades that come. And I guess that the place to start really is the book is explicit about we should think about the monarchy in terms of its relationship to financial capitalism, which is something that really we don't think about usually. And I'm really keen to hear a bit about sort of what that means. You know, what does financial capitalism, what does monarchy's relationship to it means, and why it is we don't usually think of the monarchy like that.
Yeah, so really, I mean, I came to this topic by kind of thinking about elites, really. That's kind of my background. I think about the super rich and however we want to define that. And really, it was thinking about how the monarchy is like just not included in that kind of conversation. So there's really brilliant academic work on the elites, but there's very little that, you know, puts monarchy and aristocracy actually within that conversation. And often what you'll hear in commentary, in the mainstream press, even in like quite left-wing press actually, is that the monarchy is kind of this very traditional, very archaic, you know, institution that upholds the kind of status quo, but that isn't really relevant to contemporary conversations, and that they're too old-fashioned to understand, you know, how things work nowadays. But then actually, kind of my argument is for them to have survived this long, they have to have adapted, right? They kind of had to adapt to these different points in society. And we can see that, you know, all throughout the years, even if you go back and think, well, you know, they attached themselves to mercantile capitalism and slavery and all of these things, and then kind of shifted throughout the years to the point we are now, where we're in a moment of kind of financial capitalism, these global multinational corporations that are taking up the world's wealth. And it got me thinking how the monarchy fits in with that. And really the key moment for me, which was really well timed for me actually when I was writing this, was when the Paradise Papers came out. So this was a Guardian investigation into these companies who do offshore holdings in order to kind of avoid certain types of tax. And The Duchy of Lancaster was included in that as holding money offshore. So just thinking about, you know, how that means they're kind of using their wealth and moving their wealth in the same ways as people like Nike, for example, who are also in that same set of papers as well.
I mean, one thing in there immediately that strikes me is the book talks about, it's in the title, but also, you know, it's in the book. The book talks about the monarchy as a firm. Mm-hmm. And immediately when you're talking about, you know, global flows of capitalism and, you know, transnational corporations like Nike and stuff like this, you're talking about firms, corporations. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not talking about families almost. So I'm trying to think of the exact language, but, you know, you talk about things like it has an infrastructure. It's, you know, we should think of it as having like worker relations.
Yeah.
You know, it's got a political economy to it. You know, it's got particular kind of legal status and specific financial arrangements. And I guess this kind of idea of the monarchy as a firm is one of the book's, you know, sort of both unique contributions and actually, you know, one of the reasons that the book has got this sort of longevity. And I wonder if you could kind of unpack this idea of the monarchy as a firm for me.
Yeah, well, what you said is exactly why I gave it this name, really, and kind of thought of the firm. So the firm is actually, I mean, they use it as like an informal nickname. Apparently the Queen uses it as kind of a reference. And actually that, you know, I kind of looked at the etymology of that term and it's really kind of caught up with business, really, and nowadays corporate capital. So I kind of flipped it on its head and used it to describe it, to try and disrupt these kind of common sense understandings of what monarchy is, really. Because when we say the monarchy or we say the royal family, we get a very particular image in our head. Whereas if you start giving it a different name, like the firm, and you start thinking about it in those terms, in terms of, well, there's people working for it, there's, you know, wage labour attached to it, there's wealth coming in, there's these different kind of arms so that they get money from, so the sovereign grant, and there's all the estates, there's all the duchies and all of this. So it's kind of a way of unpacking it as an institution. It's also a way of getting it. So one of the key things I talk about in the book is this idea of front stage and backstage. So I kind of say, you know, what you open the podcast with, thinking about the Jubilee and big events, that's the front stage. But like any corporate business, there's also a backstage where there's these kind of, you know, staff who do all the work and there's, you know, all this money that goes in. So it's also a way of kind of getting at that, thinking about what, you know, what's behind the stage curtain, what's going on behind the scenes of what we normally see.
I mean, the other thing about front stage is the relationship with media.
Mm.
And, you know, we have a sort of like the ultimate expression of front stage, which is both how the monarchy is represented in media, but also how the monarchy as a firm tries to kind of manage the media. Mm. And I was really fascinated by, you know, you've got some fairly kind of classic analysis of things like the coronation and, you know, these sort of like big set pieces. But also you talk a lot about royal social media, which is kind of like a combination of incredibly, you know, fascinating, well-managed use of social media and also kind of like really cringe at the same time.
Yeah, that's true.
And I'm sort of really interested in this, you know, sort of management of front stage, what the relationship with the media is, you know, how the media is, I guess, kind of, you know, controlled and complicit at the same time.
Yeah. And well, to me, so the kind of the basis of the book really is kind of very kind of Stuart Hall, British cultural studies, thinking about that idea of consent and thinking about the idea of ideology. So thinking about how the media is kind of a vehicle through which the monarchy produces consent for its own continuation. And to me, things like social media nowadays, the book also talks about the coronation and television. So kind of how television, live television, was quite a new medium at the time. And there was kind of a lot of debate about whether the monarchy should engage with that or not and kind of what that might do. And of course, they decided to, and it was a huge success and it gave access to them in a slightly new way, I think. It gave people opportunity to kind of see what they were meant to be believing in. It made it something tangible. And I think nowadays, probably social media is the equivalent of that. And I think what social media does, and when I'm talking about this, I'm talking particularly about Prince William and Kate Middleton's account that's run by their staff. What it does is gives this idea of intimacy. So you kind of see all these pictures of them with the children. You know, there's ones of them taking the children to school. There's ones of them all playing in the garden. And it's like it's positioned as like this family photo album. So it's given this idea of kind of intimacy and access, and like we have exclusive we're kind of seen as something exclusive about their family, and we're part of their family. But then my argument is, of course, that's very staged access. So it's not as though, you know, Kate Middleton is literally, you know, on a phone tweeting herself cooking dinner, and it's not that, it's not the same kind of thing we see from celebrities, for example. It's this kind of, it's very staged. It's, you know, particular shots taken at particular time for particular purposes, and it also gets into the kind of agreements they have with the media. So, for example, if they go on some holidays, they'll invite a couple of photographers to take staged photographs, which they'll then release to all the press, and then on the agreement that they'll leave them alone for the rest of the holiday. So it's this kind of very, very kind of staged, very choreographed access that gives an idea that we're getting this kind of intimate look at them, that I think is really important to that process of producing consent.
I mean, Kate Middleton is a sort of central character in the book, and we might actually jump really sort of forward and carry on talking about her and the way that, you know, she is kind of presented and almost, you know, curated on social media. You later on in the book, you talk about the idea that the firm has been Middletonianized, that there's been a Middletonianization of this institution. And I was fascinated by that because it's, as you've said earlier, you know, it's one of the ways that the institution changes to stay relevant, but it's also how a fairly static set of, you know, sort of middle-class heteronormative values carry on underpinning what the institution is, even if it seems as if it's changing. And I'm fascinated to hear a bit more about Middletonianization, kind of what it means and how, I suppose, as you've said already, you know, in terms of social media, how it's practiced as well.
Yeah. I mean, to me, that term is kind of getting this idea of social class. And I think we can see that in other people in the roles as well. But I think Kate is a particularly interesting example. The way in which she was positioned as ordinary. And, you know, there was newspaper headlines that called her a commoner around the time of the wedding. Well, of course, her family's a, you know, her family are multimillionaires. But I suppose related to the royal family, if we're doing it that way, then perhaps. But I think there's something around how the monarchy is kind of reproducing the popular imagination. And I guess, you know, even 50 years ago, they could get away with kind of marrying aristocrats and staying with their own social class group, if you will. But I think nowadays, when we've seen, you know, a lean towards kind of a popular understanding of meritocracy as an ideology, and how, you know, people, there's a lot of talk around when we talk about billionaires and how people legitimate the wealth of billionaires, they talk about, well, they worked really hard, right? They set up their own business. They worked so hard for years. They deserve that wealth. And to me, I think the monarchy needed to tap into that. They kind of couldn't get away with this kind of it being around kind of hereditary and it's just how things are. They kind of needed to tap into that popular imagination and kind of make themselves seem accessible. Like anybody can kind of be royal if you're in the right place at the right time. And Kate, I think Kate really did that. Kate was a vehicle for that. So showing how, you know, there was a lot of talk around her, you know, meeting William at university and how they fell in love, and that very kind of class mobility kind of storyline that I think she really embodies. And to me, that's really important for making the monarchy fit for purpose for this particular time. And you can still see that playing out on the social media. Like I said, they're positioned as a very middle class, upper middle class family in the way they kind of look after their children. We very rarely, for example, see nannies in any pictures, at least not pictures they release anyway, even though we know there's a whole team of them. So the way that's kind of set up, you know, as this kind of aspirational family, I suppose.
Not anyone can be part of the monarchy. No. And again, you know, the book, as you mentioned, draws, you know, from that sort of lineage of British cultural studies, and it is a profoundly sort of sociological book. But it's almost kind of inescapable that you end up foregrounding particular people and personalities as examples of particular structural failings of the institution. Mm. And the really obvious contrast is Meghan Markle and Kate Middleton. And I was fascinated by how, you know, you avoid a series of, you know, sort of cliches in this analysis, and you try and focus on both how the firm really, you know, use this as a moment of diversity capitalism, as you call it, but also how it tells us that, you know, there are real kind of limits to the way the institution changes to fit in with contemporary life.
Mm. I mean, I think Megan's a really fascinating example, and it's quite hard to theorize because it's moving so quickly and it's kind of happening, which is part of the problem with media studies work, isn't it? But I think Megan, in lots of ways, Megan does quite similar things to Kate. You know, she's kind of seen as a celebrity. It's kind of tapping into another version of anyone can join the royal family, and the royal family are attached to these different kind of networks in society. But she was also, I mean, you know, she was a millionaire. She had her own career. She's very different in that, you know, from Kate, all we see is what her royal self, that's all we really know about her. Whereas Megan had this entirely constructed, you know, public persona. And I think that that's one thing that made it quite hard, I think, for her to kind of integrate into the royal family, because we kind of can put all of these narratives on her, like when she, you know, she was very publicly anti-Brexit, for example. And of course, the royal family are meant to be politically neutral. But of course, I mean, with Meghan, there's always going to be the issue of race. So when I started writing the Meghan chapter, we were kind of coming out of the royal wedding, wedding to Harry, and there was very much this talk around how she was going to modernize the institution, you know, how it was like a new dawn. It was showing how the monarchy was really progressive. You know, there's loads of really positive newspaper coverage about it, and then it very quickly took a very steep downward turn, particularly in kind of the tabloid media, in terms of quite a very kind of racist coverage, particularly comparing to the coverage that Kate got. So there's that really famous example of there was a newspaper headline of Kate Middleton liking avocados, and it was talking about how, oh, she looks, you know, she's looking after her baby, she's into healthy food. And then there was a headline about Meghan Markle liking avocados, and it was that she was fueling drought and poverty in the areas where avocados are grown. So these kind of, those really obvious ones, but also more kind of, you know, subtle examples, I guess. So I kind of, my argument about Meghan is, you know, how all of that, you know, she was kind of meant to, my position was she was brought in to do that work of kind of making the institution appear progressive, and making it seem like it's fit for kind of, you know, multicultural Britain as it is now. But that kind of, that image was almost too much for the monarchy to contain. It was too much to put on one woman, for one, but it was also kind of too much symbolism for them to possibly contain, because, you know, there's these kind of thousands of years of history of colonialism and racism and all of these things built into that institution, that kind of the presence of one mixed race woman isn't going to fix overnight. So rather than kind of mitigating some of those histories, my argument is that Meghan merely, or Meghan's presence, this isn't about Meghan as an individual, Meghan's presence kind of brought those just further into view. Because it kind of started to make us question and think about issues of race in the royal family. And then, of course, you know, there was the Harry and Meghan's interview with Oprah Winfrey, which happened, I think it was like 2 weeks after I submitted this manuscript, which was frustrating. But, you know, how that really shone a light on, I mean, it was an incredible interview, you know, how it really kind of shed a light on how institutional racism might still be at work today as well.
I mean, there's fascinating stuff to foreground this, and, you know, there's loads of different ways we could sort of get deeper into it, and a couple of things I actually connect to these questions about the sort of the role of, as you say, you know, it's not one person, you know, these are it's not one personality, you know, these are important sort of structural positions in contemporary British society, and a good example of that actually is the Queen herself. I guess, you know, just as we've talked about the questions of race and Meghan and how race is represented and how, you know, the idea of a kind of like post-racial monarchy really sort of, you know, runs into the reality of some institutional racism that's, you know, quite clearly captured both in the media but within the institution. We also see, I guess, a similar set of themes when we think about the Queen's role in society. And there are lots of different sort of examples in the book. But one of them I was really struck by was a long discussion about the idea of the Queen's body And both, you know, how it's represented, how things like power is represented recently in the UK. You know, we saw the Queen unable to fill a civic duty and the crown standing in proxy for her, like, you know, literally the big jeweled helmet wears, you know, sort of standing in proxy for her. And why does, I guess, the kind of the royal body matter in British politics and in British society?
Yeah, so that chapter, I mean, that chapter that you're talking about is tied up with the Scottish referendum and the way in which the Queen's body was used as symbolic as a kind of united kingdom. So, you know, when the Scottish referendum didn't go through, her image was kind of used as a way to talk about how the kind of country is coming together. So from that, I kind of got two ideas of the monarch's body as politically symbolic and socially symbolic, and how we can kind of project meaning and particular ideas of what Britain is and what Britain isn't onto that particular kind of symbolic body. And I mean, there's a lot of you know, political philosophy that talks about the monarch having two bodies. So there's their natural body, which is them as a physical person, right? Them as a kind of moving, breathing person. But then there's also the symbolic body that's is about what they're invested with in terms of power and in terms of queenship, if that's the right word, and kind of in terms of royalty and what that symbolism might mean. So I kind of split that off and thought about that. And I agree, you could see it really clearly in that in the state opening of Parliament, where I think you could really see it as well. And I found this really interesting. I don't know if you remember, a couple of years ago, there was a state opening of Parliament where the Queen wore a blue outfit with a blue hat with yellow flowers on it. And it was around the time of Brexit, and people said, oh, you know, the flag, her hat looks like the EU flag. It must mean that she supports the EU and she doesn't want Brexit to happen. So just that was really interesting in terms of the ways in which, you know, the monarch's body is kind of, you can read anything onto it, and it comes to symbolize kind of the beliefs and the ideologies of the citizens, I suppose, and how it can kind of, you know, imbibe all of those different things because it's a symbolic entity. And also, I suppose part of that is helped by the fact that, you know, we very rarely see the Queen do an interview. We don't really know what she thinks about anything. There's these little rumours, but not really. And we can almost like read anything onto her in a way. And I think that's where her kind of the power of her symbolism comes from. In that she kind of has never given those political opinions, so anyone can read anything onto her and kind of have her symbolise any of these things. And I think that's incredibly powerful, actually, you know, in a society that if you're the figurehead, if anyone can read anything they want onto you, you're covering so many different bases as well.
But, I mean, we can sort of like... I was going to say we can divine some of their opinions, but that's like probably not the right word in terms of monarchy and sort of theories of monarchy. But we can get a sense of, I guess, what the institution thinks, particularly through, you know, we've seen when we've been discussing race and we've been discussing particular values that come through on social media. But actually, there are visions for Britain that have, you know, physical expressions in terms of the royal estates, in terms of royal buildings. Yeah. And one of the things you try and highlight is that, you know, even with those kind of chameleon-like moments for the institution where they try and change to fit in with prevailing trends in modern British society, we can still see quite regressive and quite conservative visions for what Britain should be. Mm. And one of these things comes up in the discussion of Poundbury, which is a fascinating kind of mini case study, and I guess kind of takes us a bit beyond actually the Queen and into some of the ways that royal children have particular views and particular positions in contemporary British society as well.
Yeah. I mean, I could talk about Poundbury all day. I think it's incredible. If people have a chance to go, do. It's so interesting and strange. So Poundbury is so it's an extension to the town of Dorchester, and it was built on Duchy of Cornwall land. So Charles is the Duke of Cornwall. And it was built, the land was released to the council for them to build this on the agreement that Charles could design it. So they built Poundbury based on particular beliefs in architecture. So he's kind of waged a war on modernist architecture for quite a long time, calling it ugly and all of these things, which is quite interesting when you think of kind of the history of modernist architecture as being about equality, basically, as being about kind of getting rid of the hidden vestibules for staff to climb down, and glass everywhere, and kind of, and even post-war, kind of getting rid of slums, for example, and building these big high-rise buildings. It was about equality. So his kind of war on that is quite interesting anyway. And he's kind of positioned as this kind of, you know, green warrior, thinking about, you know, he talks about restoring the past and restoring harmony to the country. But then he's attacking an architecture that is associated with, you know, particular types of progressive politics, which is quite interesting. So Poundbury is built on this new urbanist architectural principles, which is he's described as kind of the opposite of modernism, which is kind of very, you know, old buildings. They're designed to look old. They're designed to kind of draw on particular parts of history. You know, they've got Roman numerals on the side of them to say when they were built. So it looks like they were built in like 1650, but actually it says 2015. So that kind of very pastiche, very kind of fake. The local store, so it's designed to look like a little village corner store, you know, very old-fashioned pillars and all of this, but you go in and it's actually a branch of Budgeons, which is just designed to look like this really old-fashioned building. So kind of the ways, you know, how that's invested in particular types of class inequality as well, and it's around accessibility. So part of it is like it restricts car access because cars are meant to be ugly and make the environment ugly. And it does gravel paths because that's prettier. But of course, you can't push a wheelchair or push a pram down a gravel path. So kind of how it restricts, you know, spaces to particular kinds of bodies, and kind of reinvests us with this kind of very old fashioned, you know, version of Britain that was about class inequality, that was about like the landlord and the serf and all of those things. So I think it's interesting how Charles, you know, it very much paints himself as this kind of eco-warrior of the future, but actually he's recreating these spaces that are just bringing us back to a past.
I mean, the bringing back to the past is a sort of fascinating reoccurring theme throughout the book. And I guess if we were sort of trying to sum up the book, which is slightly impossible because there's so many examples and so much going on, it might be this moment which has brought, you know, the monarchy together with what you describe as philanthrocapitalism, in the form of the Invictus Games. And it's, you were saying about, you know, the sort of the Oprah interview dropping shortly after the book had been wrapped up, and the Invictus Games is fascinating as well, because on the one hand you've got something that, you know, Harry was the kind of driving force for, but, you know, is now, I guess, a kind of fairly well established, you know, event that's happens almost kind of without him. And it is, you know, one of these ways that the institution kind of says, we're great guys, you know, we're lovely people, we're sort of giving something back, whilst at the same time, you know, as you've said with Poundbury, there are quite sort of, you know, regressive and quite sort of conservative attitudes in some ways, and it, you know, very much draws attention away from, hang on, you know, what are the sort of financial, constitutional, political arrangements that the monarchy's got. So what are the Invictus Games, and I guess kind of like how do they sort of sum up this story that the book is trying to tell?
Yeah, so the Invictus Games is a sporting event it's very similar to the idea of Help for Heroes, where there's kind of these multinational sports teams of individuals who have been injured in wars all around the world, and they come together to do various kind of sporting events. And it's headed by Prince Harry, who of course went to Iraq and fought in that war. And if anyone's interested in the book, I kind of tell a story around that. It's kind of a corporate war and Harry's place within that as well. I won't go into that now. But for me, what the Invictus Games kind of summarizes this idea of duty. So what we often see, you know, when we hear about the royals is this idea that, you know, they work really hard, they're doing their duty, they don't want to do their job, you know, it's part of their duties. And a big part of that is charity work and philanthropy. And Invictus Games is, you know, positioned as that. It's positioned as kind of, you know, philanthropy for these injured soldiers, giving them purpose and all of this, which I'm certainly not disputing. And my analysis is in no way to kind of minimize, I'm sure, the very positive effects on those individuals. But my particular argument around Invictus is that a lot of the work is around the Afghanistan and Iraqi wars. which, you know, in the last few years we've seen various kind of papers being published that show that that war was not entirely illegal. It wasn't really a national war fought for kind of national purposes. It was, you know, positioned as kind of this war on terror, and terror isn't a thing, right? So it's kind of this very difficult to pinpoint. So how Invictus Games kind of feeds into that process of legitimating that war, and legitimating that process, and legitimating kind of the capital gains that came from that war, in terms of, you know, there's various kind of accounts that suggest it was all about kind of getting oil and all of these things. So how it kind of, it repositions what was essentially a corporate war into this idea of kind of nationalism, and makes it around, you know, kind of national identity and all of those issues, which is a way of legitimating that whole situation. So my argument around Invictus is that kind of, especially with the presence of Prince Harry, right, as kind of, well, was, you know, a member of the royal family, kind of nationally symbolic, you know, his presence within that is a way of kind of making that into this idea, you know, very powerful idea of nationalism. While also, of course, being useful for the royal family, because they can tap into that idea of, oh, well, you know, we did really well, we're doing really good things, we're working really hard, we're doing all of these, you know, great initiatives that have really positive effects on people, therefore we kind of deserve our position. And that's what you'll often see, you know, in the newspapers, in the mainstream media, what you'll often see is, oh, you know, that, well, the Queen did 346, you know, whatever, engagements this year, right? It's a kind of way of quantifying their work and therefore legitimating the fact that they, you know, apparently seem to work hard and all of these things, which of course then legitimates their position, because it makes it seem as though the wealth they get is deserved and they deserve the wage and so on. So my argument is kind of philanthropy is a really key way in which we kind of see the monarchy being reproduced. And then of course the media, going back to the media, will then go and cover all of those charity visits, because they'll, you know, they'll always go along to them. The front page will be, you know, this royal did this charity event yesterday. And again, that's kind of reproducing that idea of doing good, right? And giving back, giving something back to society.
I mean, it's tricky, isn't it? They're a sort of slightly slippery subject, because there is, you know, this sense of, you know, there are these positive social contributions, and yet these positive social contributions in some ways, you know, if they're not obscuring the interrelationships with most of the kind of structural social problems we've got in British and actually global society, then certainly, you know, they're displacing where some of the discussion
I should have said that as well. And how you know, the fact that this charity is doing the work of helping injured soldiers when the state has long been accused of giving them absolutely no help. You know, the amount of soldiers who are now homeless, for example, the figures are shocking. So how that kind of, you know, other charities coming in and doing that work really feeds into that kind of neoliberal state where, you know, the people are doing the work and the state can kind of just let that happen as well.
Yeah, and that actually was going to set up, I guess, both the conclusion to the book, but also my last question, really, which is, why does the monarchy matter here? You know, it's really clear that, you know, there are loads of things that, you know, at least need to be reformed about the institution. But actually there's, you know, a real kind of central question about, in some ways, I guess, why sociology is not paid attention to the monarchy in ways that it should, but also, you know, sort of more generally, both at this moment, but also historically and into the future, why the monarchy matters.
Yeah, I mean, in the book, and we've gone through a few examples here, and there are millions more, I kind of had to, you know, edit it down, and I attached particular royals to particular ideas to try and simplify the story, I suppose. I think for me, I think it's really fascinating that sociology isn't interested in the monarchy, actually, and kind of baffling. And I still kind of get the question, well, why are you researching that? You know, there are much more, you know, there's all these other things going on. And I've had people say, you know, there are much more important things to be worrying about, suggesting kind of poverty and homelessness and all of these things. And my kind of answer to that, and what I set the book up with, actually, I say, you know, monarchy is behind all of those things. In a society, you know, people always say, but the British are obsessed with class. Well, is it any wonder if we're in a society where kind of class hierarchy is literally built into our very system? You know, we're meant to believe that these people are above us, and then we're kind of meant to be subservient to that. So that kind of, you know, class inequality is literally built into who we are. That's, you know, people say the monarchy is the thing where most kind of symbols Britain the most. Well, great. So class inequality symbolizes Britain the most then. So my kind of argument is that you can't talk about poverty. You can't talk about all of these things that are apparently more important without discussing the monarchy as part of that, because they kind of uphold that entire system to me. You know, they create the conditions within which class inequality can exist in this country. You know, we have things like the aristocracy and things like that, for instance. Well, all of those are kind of caught up within the same story. So I think for me, and I think that, you know, the monarchy talks to all sorts of different issues. So there we've kind of talked about, you know, abdicating the state of, you know, of responsibility, for example, for taking responsibility for its citizens. And, you know, we can see the world doing that through charity work, for example, the different organisations they go to. Lots of them have been set up because the state has failed to protect its citizens. We can see that in issues of national identity and how that's caught up with kind of this monarch and the symbolism of that when we think, you know, hundreds of years of, you know, building that through various kind of images, and how that's very white. You know, it's very patriarchal, even if it's a woman, it's still very patriarchal. It speaks to, you know, issues around gender and gender inequality. It speaks to issues of colonialism and colonialist histories and how we think about the empire. And, you know, it's not unattached, in my opinion, from all these polls that say so many people in Britain are proud of the empire because of that kind of romanticization of that history. So for me, kind of, you know, why we should be interested in monarchy is because it's caught up in all of these different things. And we can kind of, you know, we can look at it and kind of speak to all of these different elements in society. And so, you know, for me, kind of having that as the basis for how we start to think about Britain and what Britain is and all of those different questions, they're absolutely essential to that.
The obvious question that comes from that is, so you're going to do loads more work on this then?
Yeah, just me.
Or, I mean, to be fair, one of the things about writing a book is there is an element of kind of closure. Even a book that has, you know, sort of an immediate contemporary relevance, there's always an element of closure with writing and finishing a book. Are you thinking in terms of sort of doing something related, something completely different? Where next in terms of your own work?
Yeah, what I'd like to do, and if anyone's listening and would like to discuss it, I'd be really interested to, is thinking about republicanism. So thinking about how, you know, we're still in a position where to say you're a Republican is like pretty taboo. To kind of outwardly criticise the monarchy. So I just did an interview actually with BBC Radio 5 Live, talking about how we should get rid of the monarchy. And someone texted in and said that they were really upset that you would dare to disrespect the Queen, particularly in the week of the Jubilee. And that kind of attitude around kind of any criticism of the monarchy, I find really fascinating. So what I want to think about next is kind of why we don't see republicanism being talked about, you know, why it's not visible in politics, why it's not visible in mainstream press, why even amongst kind of left-wing commentary and media, actually, it's not really that well, not that commonly spoken about. It's not kind of built into particular manifestos, for example. That's what I'd like to think about, kind of the invisibility of that and what that means, and kind of people's, you know, people don't understand what a republic would look like, because why would they? Because we never talk about it. So thinking about some of those issues of how we might be able to think of alternative futures.